If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. As far back as the archaeological record can take us, we can find evidence of blind people. But the experiences of those people and the ways that they were seen by others have always been hugely shaped by the historical context in which they lived. Writer and broadcaster Selina Mills' new book, Life Unseen, explores the forces that have impacted the lives of blind people through the centuries. From religious ideas and mythical tropes to Braille and schools for blind children. And I spoke to her to find out more. So thank you so much for joining me, Selina, to talk about your book, Life Unseen, A Story of Blindness. The book is part history and it's part memoir. So to start us off, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your own connection to this story and why you wanted to delve into the history of blindness.
I think I started because I was losing my own eyesight and still am. And I just didn't understand how the word blind and blindness was used so differently by so many different A, people, and B, eras. And I was A, surprised at how people treated me. Like, I'm the same person as I was 2 days ago. And yet I get, you know, the moment I have a cane and sunglasses, I'm suddenly either a burden on society or I'm really inspirational and so marvellous, which really annoyed me. And then I was at an alumni, you know, dinner, and all these academics started telling me what I would have been in different eras. And I was like, that's really, really interesting.
As you say, something that you examine throughout the book are stereotypes and tropes about blind people that have persisted through history, really. What are some of those key tropes or stereotypes?
Essentially, there's a sort of charitable model, which is pity, you poor, poor thing, it's terrible what's happened to you. And the solution to that pity is either a miracle, so either Jesus or God or whoever coming along and taking off this terrible burden that you carry, or inspiring. So you're Homer, you're Milton, you write beautiful poetry, you write beautiful music, you're really talented, you're very skilled. If you're very, very lucky, you might be Tiresias and have prophecy and be able to foretell the future because you can see from within and not outside. And it kind of went into the inspiration mode full on in the 19th century. So those are the sort of two main ones. And then there's a sort of a medical one, which is you're an object and you need to be fixed. And there is a solution. There's always a solution, even though for the majority of blind people, there isn't a solution. And even if there was, you might not want it. So I guess those three, medical, charitable, and inspirational, those are the main areas.
So this is a story that goes back a really long way. What's the oldest evidence we have of somebody being blind? And do we get any hints at what life might have been like for them?
So, again, I think this has to come with a caveat, which is this is what we know so far. They do know that archaeologists found, in the last 20 years, actually, not so long ago, some skeletons on the edge of the Tigris River. And all the skeletons were buried outside a cave. And these were 45,000-year-old Neanderthal skeletons. And then they found one skeleton in the cave, like on the edge, slightly propped up, you know, almost sort of like sitting back, relaxing. And they called it Nandi. And the reason they were focused on it, it was like, how come this one skeleton is on the corner of the cave? And they did some carbon data, testing for the age of the bones. They also looked at the DNA, and they also looked at sort of diseases that the bones might carry remnants of. And they found that this one skeleton, who they called Nandi, Nandi the Neanderthal, very original, he had disease all through his body, which, if taken to its fullest conclusion, would mean he was blind, probably have problems with his walking and his legs, and more than likely deaf as well. And yet he lived to be 45, whereas everybody else who died in who the skeletons around him were 28, 29. So the question then became, how does a man or a Neanderthal survive if he is more than likely blind and deaf and sitting by the side of the cave? And we don't actually know, but we have a couple of premises that we can think about. One is other skeletons, which were then at the time alive, helped him, cared for him, which means that illness and disability was not seen as a, you know, something to reject you from the tribe. It was something that was part of. It could have been also that he happened to be by the river. There's some mulberry bushes and whatever nearby, so maybe he was okay. Maybe he was just part of the gang, and everyone's like, "Oh, would you like a bit? You know, like a drumstick? Yeah, okay, fine. Nandi gets one." We just don't know exactly how he was treated, but we do know factually that he was more than likely blind, and that's 45,000 years ago. So those are the sort of traces of the past that we know.
And if we move into the ancient world, there are a lot of interesting stories and myths about blindness that begin to emerge, aren't there?
So again, you have to be careful because it's fictional. So some of the greatest playwrights, ancient classical playwrights, you know, Sophocles, Euripides, they wrote the most phenomenal stories. And there's two sides to it. One is that blindness appears as a bad thing, tragic, terrible thing, and a punishment. So you have Oedipus, and he pulls out his eyes. So he sleeps with his mother, kills his father. And the thing he does, you'd think it'd be another organ, perhaps, that he might damage. But no, it's his eyes, because for the ancient Greeks, the idea of the eyesight looking upon another with love or hate was so essential that to take out your eyes is the closest thing you can do without killing yourself. And at the same time, it can be a gift. So some of the greatest myths, so Tiresias is one of the most famous ones, and he appears in Oedipus, ironically, the blind Tiresias. He has inner, you know, sagacity. He knows the future. He can warn you. He can tell you bad things are going to happen or good things are going to happen. We know that there are blind women who are prophets who also could see, allegedly, into the future. And they're sort of fictional characters, but they're considered almost deities. They're put up on the shelf of, or the mountain rather, of great knowledge. And then finally, and this is the one I think that has stayed with us, is the sort of talent. So if you're blind, you've got to be good at music. You've got to have a good memory. And the one that everyone speaks to is Homer. So Homer, who writes the Odyssey, and writes Ulysses, was considered blind because all the statues we find of him have him with his eyes down and closed. And then we know that 100 years later, after his alleged death, as in alleged, we don't know exactly when he died, we have other writers talking about him, and they called him, in that they give him the epithet, the blind Homer. So there's a sort of mythic blind poet thing going on, which has been with us for centuries.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
And touches on that trope, doesn't it, of, as you say, if you're blind, you can't just be ordinary. There's something that you say in the book, which is there's very kind of few stories in literature about people who just happen to not be able to see. Usually the blindness is used to signify something extraordinary or incredibly different and unique, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And it happens now. I mean, that's the weird thing.
Has that happened to you? Can you give us some examples?
Yes, and actually, so one of the reasons I decided to put myself in the book as well, rather than just write a straight history book, was that I kept having experiences where it was very close to what I was reading about. So, for example, people think I have a really good memory. I might have a really good memory, but they presume it's because I can't see. And the phrase I hear pretty much every day, if not every week, is, "Oh, but you must have such good hearing." I don't know. Yeah. Or I happen to be very musical, but, you know, so were my grandparents. So I'm more than likely to have inherited it from my grandparents than I would have because I can't see. It's almost that you have to offset the terribleness of blindness, the alleged terribleness and tragedy of it all, with a compensation. So it has to be matched somehow with, "Oh, well, you can hear better." And the most famous one is, obviously, you're meant to be a better lover. And I would not like to say on BBC A History Extra, any of them will not discuss that.
Yes, we'll leave that one for the listeners to think about. People have also long obsessed over the elusive idea of a cure for blindness, which is something that you look at in your book. What ideas have people put forward in the past?
Well, the history of curing, I think we have to start with a premise here, which is it's a natural thing to do to want people not to suffer. So I think we have to start from there rather than just blindness being fixed. So we've got ancient papyrus papers of people saying, you know, "And if you squeeze the liver of a pigeon on somebody's eyes, it will get rid of blindness." And that's, you know, sort of, "Oh, okay, you know, fine." But the idea to relieve someone of the innate, quote, suffering, end quote, of it is really pervasive throughout history. But it really gets going in the 18th century. So the 18th century, particularly in the West, because I would say that I do concentrate on Western history rather than any other. The ones that really always come to mind are the 18th century, where they did horrendous things to people all in the name of curing. So like they wrapped your head in plaster to make your eyes bulge to see if that would release, you know, some sort of inner demon stroke pressure. They put electricity on your eyeballs. They made you bleed because maybe your humours were out of sort. The other thing that has changed in treatment is some blindness has been seen as a psychological events. So, for example, people who come out of wars and they are blind simply because they're in shock and their brains just shut down. The impulse to help create sight goes. But actually the eyes themselves as an organ work, they're fine. So that would be another way of other thing. And that treatment is therapy. And also something called blinking therapy, which is really interesting, where in order to stop trauma reappearing, people are taught to blink and things. But anyway, so the short answer to your question is it depends on the era that you're in, but it ranges from everything which we would consider horrific to the present, where we think, gosh, how amazing.
Something else that you look at, as well as changing ideas about science and cures for blindness, are changing ideas about education and how blind children should be educated. What did you find about some of the institutions or schools that were set up and how they reflected the times that they were set up in, really?
So the 19th century was really the heyday of institutions. Everyone decided that was the thing to do. So up until sort of the 19th century, you either sort of ended up begging at city walls or got hidden at home. But the 19th century, particularly in Europe, there's a sort of revolution which is like, let's create educational and working training places. But they're not pleasant. They're not like some lovely, nice, you know, sort of private boarding school. It's horrendous, often very poor, very smelly, very dirty. And people get sent away for 7 years. So literally, they don't come home again. I went to see one in America, actually, which I thought was fascinating. You come in and literally on the left side was boys go up one row, one staircase, and right side girls go up the other side. And your whole day was completely dedicated to learning to be blind. The 19th century gave this idea that you take people away from the community. And the 20th century, it was pretty much the thought too, until about the 60s, 70s, and then it got questioned. And now it's slightly different. Now people think it's better to integrate people into a community and go to the same school as your fellow sighted friends. It's a debate that goes on all the time about disability and schooling and education. But I do think the 19th century really created this idea of the institution where you send someone away. And also they have no choice. Like there is no choice and you have very little freedom. And you don't get to see, you know, your family. And you certainly don't get to have a relationship with anybody because you're very, very controlled. It's quite shocking, actually. My sister and I had long chats about it, and we were saying how, had I been born earlier, I might have ended up in a school simply because it was, you know, a special school because that was what you do. And some people, I have friends who are blind who went to some amazing schools, which were deliberately created to help blind kids, and had a whale of a time and were incredibly supported. But I think that's a modern, I mean, I think the modern education system wouldn't allow people to be kind of separated and objectified. So I think it's an ongoing debate about education.
I think that raises a really interesting point about your book, because it's not an objective history, is it? Like, because it's part memoir as well, you're really involved in this history. As you say, you get a vision of what your life might possibly have been like if you lived at a different time. What was that experience of uncovering some of these stories and these past experiences like?
It was very moving. I did try and write the book as a straight history book, and I couldn't do it because so much affected me. And that's why I ended up in, I sort of merged the two. In some ways, it was very difficult because you realise not much has changed in terms of stigma, objectification, separating blind people into this special community, even if really, really well meant.
What have been some of the most important tools or strategies, perhaps, that have been invented that have really helped blind people in their daily lives and helped improve blind people's lives?
I think sometimes it's individual, so each person finds their own strategy. The invention of various technologies of this era, 19th century and before, obviously, it depended on if you had money and access to learning. So I love the 18th century blind musician Teresa von Parody, who got strips of silk and put knots in them so she could tell or remind herself where the music changed, either rhythm or key. And you think, wow, that's cool. She also invented raised maps. So she had her court engineer create a map for her so she could feel how the world was. There are some very obvious ones. Braille, amazing, 1828, doesn't get to be universal till 1860s, but it is the most intimate, private way of being able to read without having A, someone read to you, or B, even have a computer read to you. It's a very intimate relationship. It's as close as you can get to reading in terms of owning the words. So obviously the 20th century has, 21st and 20th century have guide dogs, you know, fantastic. And tech, you know, is phenomenal. It has completely changed my life and made my life much more independent. But I think each time you look at a new invention and you ask, you know, what helps the blind people, you also have to ask who invented it and who owns it. So for me, when I look at these things, I think, gosh, you know, guide dogs, absolutely amazing. It's interesting that there's been a push for guide dog owners to train their own dogs rather than have a group of sighted people do it. Or AI. So you have quite a few apps out there which are phenomenal, but you have to, you know, either pay for them or be there owned by other companies, which is fine, but it means that you don't have control over it. So I think what worked about Braille was it was a blind man inventing a resource for blind people, and it was free. So like there was nothing attached to it that would make it owned. And I think that was phenomenal.
One thing I did want to ask you about, which we haven't touched on, which is a theme in your book, is religion. For a long time, Christian thinkers really set the agenda in the West. How did that shape the lives of blind people? What ideas about blindness did they perpetuate or put forward?
I think, as I said, what's really interesting about the subject of blindness is that it seems to reflect whatever the society around you is, you know, immersed in itself or constructed by. So Christian religion and, I would say, Judeo-Christian religion has really impacted the West notion of the blind. The most interesting aspect is, you know, think about Genesis. In the beginning, there was light. So there's a sort of binary opposition set up pretty early on of light versus dark. And if you think and consider that light, you know, blindness is considered darkness by most, which is actually an erroneous label, then you really do understand how it's so easy to say blindness bad, sight good. You know, light, truth, knowledge, and darkness, bad, evil, burying in ground. So you've got this sort of binary opposition that's been set up from very, very early on. And it actually is pre-Judaic. I think most creation myths have an element of light good, darkness bad.
You've uncovered all these incredible stories of people in the past who were blind. Alongside the ones that you've already shared with us, were there any that particularly resonated with you?
A couple, particularly as a woman losing her sight. And things also changed as I was researching. So I started this book about 10 years ago, all the research for it. And then as I was uncovering other historians, academic specialists, really found the most extraordinary people who, I call it on the corridors of history or the hillside of history. They're there. We just don't see them. So my favourite, I think there's a woman called Elizabeth Gilbert, who's not the writer of Eat, Pray, Love, but a Victorian philanthropist. So she was educated, had a bit of money, and she's gets scarlet fever when she's 18 months or something. And, you know, and she's about 1850s. And she happens to be the daughter of a master at an Oxford college. And so she gets access to knowledge and training that most blind women of her generation wouldn't have. And because of that, she gets to 23 and she writes to her father, I think through a amanuensis, and says, you know, I really know that I'm probably not going to be on the marriage market. You know, in Victorian Britain, probably not my thing. But what I'd really like to do is help people. And so while the RNIB is also set up around the same time, sort of the late 19th century, a woman goes and starts a factory for blind people in Holborn in London, and everybody in the factory is blind, except one man at the door who's sighted, who checks the goods that they make to make sure everything's okay. And all the money goes back in. It's like sort of a John Lewis. All the money goes back into the group, and they have a library, they have a choir, they have pensions. It's just the most extraordinary sort of advanced community of blind people. And it's set up by a woman, and she writes to Queen Victoria and she goes, please may I have some money? And she writes to Gladstone and she writes to Disraeli, and they all help. And it's definitely part of the do-gooding philanthropic wave that's going through Britain at the time. But at the same time, you think how amazing that this woman gets to find not only a voice, but create a platform for other people that is shared and equal, and it's not hierarchical. And it's just, it was phenomenal. I'm always saying, and she was called, her nickname was Bessie. So I was like, Bessie.
That is an amazing story. In the conclusion to your book, you say, has my notion of blindness changed after this gallop through history? Absolutely, yes. How so?
I think the most fundamental thing I learned and I carry with me now is that blindness is part of society. It's not a separate thing. And it's been with us since Nandi the Neanderthal from 45,000 years ago. So I think having thought of myself as someone who was becoming objectified or being treated differently, I felt better because I thought, okay, I'm part of womankind, and I feel rather almost proud. You know, it gave me the right to be here in a way that maybe the sighted community couldn't give me. So people are very generous and they're, oh, you're doing so amazingly and you're so wonderful and good on you. And it's all a little bit lovely and patronising. But at the same time, I'm allowed to be here and not see. Because I think the thing about not seeing is that people think, oh, well, you need help and you need, you know, you're either a burden or an inspiration, but you can't just be here. And that's what I really like about it. It really helped me with that.
That was Selina Mills speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorne. Selina is the author of Life Unseen, A Story of Blindness, which is on sale now. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.